In a logo, layers of lavender horizontal bars push together to form a triangle. A smaller black triangle is cut into the side. Live entertainment. Now a white horse gallops through a dawning blue sky, its mane fluttering in the wind. It sprouts wings and soars up and over a golden triangle enclosing the words TriStar Pictures. A point of blue neon light arcs back and forth, forming a letter C with five layers. White light flares from the C as the color fades to black and white. Carolco. Against a black screen, sharply angled prisms appear, reflecting a moving image. Flashes of a woman's bare body rock and sway in the shards of glass. Titles appear. Mario Casar presents a Carolco Le Studio Canal Plus production, a Paul Verhoeven film, starring Michael Douglas as Nick Curran in Basic Instinct. Also starring Sharon Stone as Catherine Tramell, George Zunza, Gene Triplehorn, Dennis Arndt, Leilani Sorrell, Bruce A. Young, Chelsea Ross, Wayne Knight, Daniel von Bargen, Stephen Tobolowsky, and Benjamin Mouton. More titles. Casting by Howard Fair. Associate producers William S. Beasley and Louis Desposito. Costumes designed by Ellen Morajnik. Music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith. Special makeup effects designed and created by Rob Button. Editor Frank J. Uriosity, ACE. Production designer Terrence Marsh. Director of Photography Jan DuBont, ASC. Executive producer Mario Casar. Written by Joe Esterhaas. Produced by Alan Marshall. Directed by Paul Verhoeven. Nighttime. A mirror looks down from a ceiling onto an ornately decorated room. Its reflection shows a naked couple making love in bed. Limbs entwined, they lie amid crumpled, cream-colored sheets. Our view tilts down to the bed as the woman rolls on top of the man and straddles him. Her medium-length blonde hair hangs down, obscuring her face. She slides her fingers into his mouth. He sucks them eagerly. 40-ish. He is handsome, with a curly head of salt and pepper hair. The woman is slender, with small breasts, smooth skin, and a toned body. She writhes on top of him. He grabs her hips and gently squeezes. She lifts his hands and places them against the wrought iron headboard. Then she tugs a white silk scarf out from the pillow beneath his head. Taking one end, she ties his right wrist to the headboard, then his left. As she leans over him, he kisses her nipple. She sits back, thrusting her hips. He winces in ecstasy and grits his teeth. Rocking on top of him, she leans back, jutting her breasts, and slides her fingers across the mattress. She slips a sharp, gleaming ice pick out from under the sheets and jams it into his neck. As she stabs him repeatedly, blood splatters everywhere, coating her arms and breasts. Daytime. A brown sedan pulls up to a crowded sidewalk. Two 40-ish men hop out. One is jowly and beer-bellied, the other slim and handsome. Heading to a brownstone, they stride past a policeman.
Morning, detective.
You got it back, folks.
The two detectives step inside. Climb a carpeted staircase into a hallway and stop to glance at a Picasso painting on a wall. Several officers stroll past.
How's it going, Gus?
Morning, Pete. Who is this fucking guy?
Rock and roll, Gus. Johnny Boz.
Never heard of him.
For your time, cowboy. Hey, Ronnie, where are they hiding?
Upstairs, to the right.
Mid-60s. He had 5 or 6 hits. Got a club down on Fillmore now.
Not now, he don't.
They enter the ornate bedroom.
Do we have a time of death?
Almost.
Do you guys know Captain Talcott?
Sure.
What's the chief's office doing here?
Observing.
A medical examiner grips a thermometer.
What's it say, Doc?
92 degrees. It's about 6 hours. Puts time of death around 2 a.m. plus or minus.
Can somebody close the drapes over there?
Jeez, what a mess.
Maid came in about an hour ago, found the body. She's not a live-in.
Maybe the maid did it.
She's 54 years old, weighs 240 pounds.
No bruises on the body.
It ain't the maid.
Never know.
The handsome detective turns on a stereo.
Sorry.
He left the club with his girlfriend about midnight. It's the last time anybody saw him.
What was it?
Ice pick. Left it on the coffee table in the living room.
There's cum stains all over the sheets.
A detective shines a laser scanner onto the blood-stained bed as the handsome detective looks through a pair of red glasses.
Very impressive.
He got off before he got off.
Gentlemen, this is sensitive. Mr. Boz was a major contributor to the mayor's campaign. He was chairman of the board of the Palace of Fine Arts.
Well, I thought you said he was a rock and roll star.
He was a retired rock and roll star.
A civic-minded, very respectable rock and roll star.
Well, what's that over there?
A mirror lined with white powder.
Looks like civic-minded, very respectable cocaine.
The captain steps up to him.
Listen to me, Curran. I'm going to get a lot of heat on this. I don't want any mistakes.
Detective Nick Curran eyeballs him for a moment. The captain turns away.
What's Boz's girlfriend's name?
Catherine Trammell, 162 Divisadero.
Nick and the heavyset Gus start down the stairs, passing the tall, 50-ish captain.
Always a pleasure, Captain.
He's up bright and early. He doesn't usually punch in till after his 18 holes.
The mayor must have been very tight.
Mm. Hey!
Yo!
Keep your 3 o'clock.
You want me to work the case, Phil?
Keep it.
All right. I'll keep it.
The detectives walk away. The gray-haired Lieutenant Walker exchanges a glance with Captain Talcott, then heads back toward the bedroom. Now our view glides over rooftops along a posh San Francisco street. The bay lies in the horizon as the sun shines. We pause above a white-columned townhouse. Gus and the brown-haired, broad-shouldered Nick step up to the entrance. Sunglasses shade Curran's eyes. A plump Latina maid in a pale gray uniform answers the door.
Morning, I'm Detective Curran. This is Detective Moran, San Francisco Police Department. I'd like to speak to a Miss Catherine Trammell, please.
Come in.
She eyes his badge, then steps aside. The two men enter.
Sit, please. Just a moment.
They walk into a sitting room and find a large, brightly colored painting of angular bodies.
Ain't that cute? They got his and hers Picassos.
Gus, I didn't even know you knew who Picasso was.
Sure I do. It says right here.
Hers is bigger.
Nick turns as a pretty, blonde-haired woman saunters down the stairs. Black jeans and a tight vest show off her trim figure.
Sorry to bother you. Just got a couple of questions to ask.
Are you Vice?
No, we're Homicide.
What do you want?
When's the last time you saw John Boz?
Is he dead?
Why do you think he's dead?
Well, you wouldn't be here otherwise, would you?
Were you with him last night?
You're looking for Catherine, not me.
Who are you?
I'm Roxy. I'm her friend.
Pulling back her blonde hair, she trains her steely blue eyes on Nick.
Well, Roxy, do you know where your friend is?
She's out at the beach house at Stinson. Cedar 1402.
Thanks.
Nick and Gus start for the door.
You're wasting your time. Catherine didn't kill him.
With a smirking glance at Roxy, Nick opens the door and they walk out. She stares after them intently. Later, the brown sedan drives along a narrow highway, curving through cliffs alongside the ocean. Hundreds of feet below, the surf washes onto the shore. As Gus drives, Nick studies the area. Thin tree branches stretch out above the winding road, forming a leafy canopy. Moments later, the sedan skids onto a driveway and parks beside two identical sports cars, one white, one black. Gus and Nick climb out and approach a beach house with frosted glass double doors. Gus knocks while Nick paces.
Gus.
Nick points to a stone stairway beside the house. They walk down to a path which leads to a wooden deck overlooking the ocean. An alluring blonde woman sits curled up in a chair, her back to them. As the men approach, she takes a drag from a cigarette and gazes out at the bluffs and breaking waves below.
Miss Trammell?
With a cool smile over her shoulder, she takes a deep puff, then flicks the cigarette away. As she turns back to stare at the ocean, Nick pulls off his sunglasses. He nods knowingly, the crow's feet around his hazel eyes crinkling warily. They sidle up to her.
Good afternoon. I'm Detective Curran. This is Detective Moran. We're with the San Francisco Police.
I know who you are. So how did he die?
He was murdered.
Obviously. How was he murdered?
With an ice pick.
Catherine flashes a sly half-smile.
How long were you dating him?
I wasn't dating him. I was fucking him.
What are you, a pro?
No, I'm an amateur.
How long were you having sex with him?
About a year and a half.
Were you with him last night?
Yes.
Did you leave the club with him?
Yes.
Did you go home with him?
No. We had a drink at the club. We left together. He went home and I came out here.
Was there anyone with you last night?
No. I wasn't in the mood last night.
She looks up at him with eyes as clear blue as the sea. Gus watches Nick, who steps closer to her.
Let me ask you something, Miss Trammell. Are you sorry he's dead?
Yeah. I liked fucking him.
He studies her carefully. She returns his gaze, then glances away.
Look, I don't really feel like talking anymore.
Listen, lady, we can do this downtown if you want.
So read me my rights and arrest me. And then I'll go downtown.
She smiles. Nick shoots an uneasy look at his partner.
Otherwise, get the fuck out of here.
Gus studies her, his gaze hard and flinty. She turns to Nick with a coy expression.
Please.
Nick Curran looks at Gus for a moment, then glances back at her. As he eyes Catherine stoically, he and Gus saunter off. She stares after them, then settles back into her chair and faces the ocean. Later, the detectives sit in their car heading back down the cliffs. Passing the Golden Gate Bridge, they both grin.
Nice girl.
At police headquarters, Nick strides down a hallway to a door marked Dr. Elizabeth Garner Counseling. He marches into a cozy office and finds a beautiful brunette with bee-stung lips. She has a toned figure and wears a stylish suit and tortoiseshell glasses.
I'm sorry, Beth. I got hung up at Stinson.
How are you, Nick?
I'm fine. Oh, come on, Beth. You know I'm fine. How long we got to keep doing this?
As long as Internal Affairs wants you to, I suppose. Have a seat.
It's bullshit, okay? You know it is.
I know it is. But sit down anyway so we can get it over with, okay?
She sits behind her desk. He takes a seat across from her and loosens his tie. Beth removes her glasses.
So, how are things?
Things are fine. I told you, all right? Things are fine.
How's your personal life?
My sex life is fine. My sex life's actually pretty shitty since I stopped seeing you.
He holds up his left palm.
Started developing calluses.
Her brown eyes regard him coldly. Nick lowers his hand.
Sorry.
He leans back.
How's the booze?
Haven't had a drink in 3 months.
What about the coke?
No.
No?
No. No, I'm working my ass off. I'm off the sauce. I even stopped smoking.
They share a chuckle.
Hal's not smoking.
It sucks. Now, you tell IA I'm just your average, healthy, totally fucked up cop. And let me out of here. Please.
Leaning across the desk, she brings her face close to his.
Yes.
Thank you.
He looks deeply into her eyes for a moment, then rises and starts toward the door. Her expression clouds.
I still miss you, Nick.
He pauses for a moment in the doorway, then heads for the stairwell. Beth lowers her gaze. Downstairs in the squad room, Gus sips a soda at his desk as Nick approaches. Nice.
Talcott's in there. They're waiting. How'd it go?
She misses me.
Boy, when that girl mates, it's for life.
They enter Walker's office. Detective Harrigan.
Well, we got 31 stab wounds, neck and the chest. No usable prints, no forcible entry, nothing missing. No prints on the ice pick either. Yeah, you can pick it up at any Kmart. The scarf was Hermes. It's expensive. They sell about 20,000 a year worldwide.
Part of it was cocaine. High quality, high content. He inhaled it. There were minute quantities on his lips and penis.
Detective Andrews.
Bosley's $5 million, no direct survivors, no criminal record. Liked his drugs, he liked his girls, he liked his rock and roll.
He liked the mayor too, right?
Talcott glares at him. Nick takes a sip from a coffee mug.
What about his girlfriend?
Is she relevant here? Is she a suspect?
She's a suspect.
On what basis?
Girlfriend, Catherine Trammell, age 30. No priors, no convictions. Magna cum laude, Berkeley, 1983. Double major, literature and psychology. Daughter, sole survivor, Marvin and Elaine Trammell, killed in the boating accident, 1979. Catherine Trammell, sole heir. Estimated assets, $110 million.
You're shitting me.
Formerly engaged to Manuel Vasquez, deceased.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Manny Vasquez?
Manny Vasquez, former middleweight contender, killed in the ring, Atlantic City, 1984.
I love it. She got $100 million. She fucks fighters and rock and roll stars, and she's got a degree in screwing people's heads.
You forgot about her degree in literature. She's a writer. She published a novel last year under a pen name. Want to know what it's about? It's about a retired rock and roll star who gets murdered by his girlfriend.
Nighttime. Nick sits in his apartment, leafing through a paperback novel. Resting the open book on his chest, he picks up a telephone and dials a number.
Page 67, cowboy. You know how she does the boyfriend? With an ice pick. In bed, his hands tied with a white silk scarf.
The book cover reads, Love Hurts, by Catherine Wolfe.
Dr. Garner?
Daytime in a conference room.
I've asked Dr. Lamont to consult with us. This isn't really my turf. Dr. Lamont teaches the pathology of psychopathic behavior at Stanford and is also a member of the Justice Department's psychological profile team. Dr. Lamont.
He sits at the head of the table.
I see two possibilities. One, the person who wrote this book is your murderer and acted out the killing described in ritualistic, literal detail. Two, someone who wants to harm the writer read the book and enacted the killing described to incriminate her.
What if the writer did it, then what are we dealing with?
You're dealing with a devious, diabolical mind. You see, this book had to have been written at least 6 months, maybe even years, before it was published, which means that the writer had to have at least planned the crime in the subconscious back then. Now, the fact that she carried it out indicates psychopathic obsessive behavior in terms not only of the killing itself, but also in terms of the applied advanced defense mechanism.
You know, sometimes I can't tell shit from Shinola, Doc. What was all that you just said?
She intended the book to be her alibi.
Correct.
She's going to say, do you think I'd be dumb enough to kill anyone in the exact way I described in my book? I wouldn't do that, because then I know I'd be the suspect.
So what if it's not the writer? What if it's someone who read the book?
You're dealing then with someone so obsessed that he or she is willing to kill an irrelevant and innocent victim in order to place the blame on the person who wrote that book. I'm talking about a deep-seated, obsessional hatred and an utter lack of respect for human life.
Gus holds out the book.
So we got a once-in-a-lifetime, top-of-the-line Looney Tune, the way you cut it. That's what you're saying, right, Doc?
You're dealing with someone very dangerous and very ill.
Now a heavyset man storms into a corridor, followed by Gus, Walker, Talcott, and Nick.
Come on. You know there's no case here. You've got no physical evidence.
She hasn't got an alibi.
Okay, she hasn't got an alibi. She hasn't got a motive either. Believe me, her defense would just beat us to death with this copycat thing. Anybody who read the book could have done it.
They step into an elevator.
So what do you want to do now?
Nothing? We call her in for questioning.
She's got enough money to burn this whole department
down. She was the last person seen with the guy, Captain Talcott. I'll take the responsibility.
It's yours.
The doors open. They get off.
Won't do any good. She'll just waltz in with some superstar lawyer who'll get us all canned for wasting the taxpayers' money.
That's exactly what she'll do.
No, she won't. I don't think she'll hide behind anybody. I don't think she's going to hide at all.
And she's as crazy as you are, Curran.
Talcott enters a courtroom with the heavyset prosecutor.
You know what to say. Takes one to know one.
Walker and Gus eye Nick. Then they walk off. Later, the brown sedan pulls up to Catherine's beach house. The two detectives climb out and approach the front door. Through the frosted glass, we watch Catherine approach. She wears a loose, off-the-shoulder brown sweater and shorts. With a tiny smirk, she opens the door.
Miss Trammell, we'd like you to come downtown to answer a few questions for us.
Are you arresting me?
That's the way you want to play it.
Could I change into something more appropriate? It'll only take a minute.
Come on in. Make yourselves comfortable. I'll be right back.
Pulling back her hair, she saunters off. Nick wanders over to a table in the living room and picks up a folded newspaper. A headline reads, "Cop cleared in tourist shooting. Grand jury says shooting accidental." He unfolds the paper to reveal a photo of himself.
You guess.
So how long is this going to take?
I don't know.
Through the open bedroom door, he spies Catherine's naked reflection in a mirror.
You always keep old newspapers around?
Only when they make interesting reading.
He steps closer and watches as she puts on a short, sleeveless white dress. Slender, she has small breasts and a toned body with smooth, creamy skin. Walking back into the living room, she throws on a chic white jacket.
I'm ready.
You have the right to an attorney.
Why would I need an attorney?
The detectives share a look as she struts to the door. Later, Catherine sits in the back of the sedan. Nick sits up front beside Gus.
Do you have a cigarette?
I don't smoke.
Yes, you do.
His brow creases in surprise.
I quit.
Congratulations.
Gus's eyes flit in Nick's direction. His partner looks away in discomfort. Behind them, Catherine whips out a cigarette and lights it. Nick shakes his head.
Thought you didn't have any cigarettes.
Oh, I found some in my pocket. Would you like one?
She holds out her open cigarette case.
I told you I quit.
It won't last.
She pockets the case. Gus shifts the rearview mirror to study her.
You working on another book?
Yes, I am.
It must really be something, making stuff up all the time.
Yeah, it teaches you to lie.
How's that?
You make stuff up. It has to be believable. It's called suspension of disbelief.
I like that. Suspension of disbelief.
What's your new book about?
She takes a thoughtful puff.
A detective? He falls for the wrong woman.
Sunlight shines through the window onto her bold gaze. Nick turns to face her.
What happens?
She kills him.
Their eyes lock together as she takes a cool, almost cunning drag. Now, in an interrogation room, the heavyset prosecutor approaches.
I'm John Corelli, Mr. Trammell, Assistant District Attorney. I have to inform you this session's being taped. This is Captain Talcott.
My pleasure.
And Lieutenant Walker.
Hi.
Can we get you anything? A cup of coffee?
No, thank you.
Are your attorneys going to join us?
Ms. Trammell has waived her rights to an attorney.
Everyone stops and stares at Nick.
Did I miss something?
I told him that you wouldn't want an attorney present.
No.
Why have you waived your right to an attorney, Mr. Trammell?
Why did you think I wouldn't want one?
I told him you wouldn't want to hide.
I have nothing to hide.
With a half smile, she glances at Nick, then takes a seat in the front of the dimly lit room. The men sit at tables facing her. Catherine takes out a cigarette and taps it on the top of her case.
There's no smoking in this building, Miss Trammell.
What are you going to do? Charge me with smoking?
The heavyset Corelli looks away. Catherine lights the cigarette, then blows out a puff of smoke. With her bare legs crossed, her short dress is hiked up to the middle of her thighs.
Would you tell us the nature of your relationship with Mr. Boz?
I had sex with him for about a year and a half. I liked having sex with him. He wasn't afraid of experimenting. I like men like that. Men who give me pleasure. He gave me a lot of pleasure.
Corelli unconsciously licks his lips.
You ever engage in any sadomasochistic activity?
Exactly what did you have in mind, Mr. Corelli?
She leans forward with an eager smile.
You ever tie him up?
No.
You never tied him up?
No. Johnny liked to use his hands too much. I like hands and fingers.
You describe a white silk scarf in your book.
I've always had a fondness for white silk scarves. They're good for all occasions.
But you said you like men to use their hands, didn't you?
No, I said I like Johnny to use his hands. I don't make any rules, Nick. I go with the flow.
Did you kill Mr. Boz, Miss Trammell?
I'd have to be pretty stupid to write a book about killing and then kill somebody the way I described it in my book. I'd be announcing myself as the killer. I'm not stupid.
We know you're not stupid, Miss Trammell.
Maybe that's what you're counting on to get you off the hook.
Writing the book gives you an alibi.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? But the answer's no. I didn't kill him.
Do you use drugs, Miss Trammell?
Sometimes.
You ever use drugs with Mr. Boz?
Sure.
What kind of drugs?
Cocaine. Have you ever fucked on cocaine, Nick?
Nick Curran glances up from his notepad. Corelli eyes him curiously. With a saucy gaze, Catherine uncrosses her thighs. She briefly exposes her pubic hair, then recrosses her legs.
It's nice.
Nick's gaze shifts from hers to Corelli's. Sweating, the assistant DA purses his lips and leans back into his chair. Nick rises and heads to a coffee maker.
You like playing games, don't you?
I have a degree in psychology. It goes with the turf. Games are fun.
What about boxing? That's a game. Is that fun, too?
I don't think that's relevant to this inquiry.
Boxing was fun till Manny died.
How'd you feel when he died?
I loved him. It hurt.
How'd you feel when I told you Johnny Boz had died?
I felt like someone had read my book and was playing a game.
But it didn't hurt.
No.
Because you didn't love him.
That's right.
Even though you were fucking him.
You still get the pleasure. Didn't you ever fuck anybody else when you were married, Nick?
How'd you know he was married?
Maybe I was just guessing. What difference does it make?
She opens her cigarette case and slides out a fresh one.
Do you like a cigarette, Nick?
She sticks it into her mouth and grins slyly at him. He chuckles contemptuously.
You two know each other?
No.
No.
How'd you meet Mr. Boz?
I wanted to write a book about the murder of a retired rock and roll star. I went down to his club, I picked him up, and I had sex with him.
You didn't feel anything for him, you just had sex with him for your book.
In the beginning. Then I got to like what he did for me.
That's pretty cold, ain't it, lady?
I'm a writer. I use people for what I write. Let the world beware.
Gus studies her, his arms crossed over his chest.
You want me to take a lie detector test?
Later, the officers watch a television monitor. On the screen, Catherine sits strapped to a polygraph machine. An interrogator stands nearby.
Wait here, please.
Pressing a button on the monitor, Nick zooms in for a close-up of her face as the interrogator comes into the room.
No blips, no blood pressure variations, no pulse variants. Either she's telling the truth, or I've never seen anyone like her.
Talcott turns to Walker.
I guess that settles it.
Walker snatches the report as they head out.
She's lying.
Forget it. You can fool me. You cannot fool the machine.
Trust me, it can be done.
And what makes you such an expert?
Because I know people that have done it.
Moments later, Talcott helps Catherine put on her jacket.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in, Miss Trammell. Sorry to inconvenience you.
Could someone give me a ride home?
Sure.
She turns to Nick.
Thank you.
As they head out, Gus turns to Walker.
Want to get a drink?
Nighttime. In a heavy downpour, Nick drives through a puddle. Water washes onto the car as the wipers slash across the windshield. Inside, he turns to Catherine.
Rough day?
Not really.
Beating that machine can't be easy.
If I was guilty and I wanted to beat that machine, it wouldn't be hard. It wouldn't be hard at all. You took a lie detector test after you shot those two people, didn't you?
I passed.
You see? We're both innocent, Nick.
He stares at her soberly, then turns back to the road. Nick's Mustang pulls up to her townhouse. Street lamps gleaming through the rain-splattered windshield throw splotched shadows onto their faces. Placing a hand on the back of her seat, he inches closer.
You seem to know an awful lot about me.
You know an awful lot about me.
I don't know anything that's not police business.
You know I don't wear any underwear, don't you, Nick?
He regards her carefully, taking in her cool gaze. She slips off her high heels and smiles.
Thanks for the ride.
Opening the door, she dashes out into the rain and sprints across the soaked sidewalk in her bare feet. He watches her enter the house. A little later, he strolls into a crowded bar, slicking back his wet hair.
Hi, Nick.
He joins Gus and Walker.
So what is all this Nick stuff? Nick, you want a cigarette? Nick, can I have a ride?
She didn't ask me to give her a ride. She asked anybody.
And you volunteered.
Hey, Nick, get me on.
No, Chucky, get me a double blackjack in the rocks, please.
What you doing, Hoss?
I haven't had a drink in 3 months. All right with you, cowboy? She doesn't know me, okay?
There you go, Nick.
I never seen her before Gus and I talked to her. Thanks, Chuck.
You're sure?
Yes, I'm sure. Cheers.
Nick takes a gulp, sets down the glass, then looks up at their stairs.
Now what?
What now what? Now nothing. She passed the polygraph. That's it.
She knew how to beat it. That's why she asked to take it.
How in the fuck do you know? What is it with you and this broad anyway?
Oh, come on, Phil. Don't let this one slide. What about her parents? What about what else she published? Maybe all her books got a funny way of coming true.
Her parents died in an accident. I don't give a shit what else she published. What are you, all of a sudden, a book critic?
How'd they die? Huh? Was there an investigation?
Now you're saying she killed her parents? Did she kill Manny Vasquez, too?
Not unless she climbed into the ring and turned into one mean son of a bitch.
Maybe she did, Gus. Maybe she grew herself an afro, developed a hell of a left hook, and put shoe polish all over her face. Let's polygraph her again and ask her.
Fuck you.
Fuck you, too, Nick.
Don't worry, Phil. Nick will fuck himself.
You're right.
A detective sits nearby.
Hey, Chucky, get me another double, will you?
Hey, shooter. Now, are you back on the blackjack? Shooter?
We're discussing the case here, Marty.
I know that. I have no doubts.
Here you go, Nick.
Oh, a double. Shooter.
Beth approaches as the detective hands Nick his drink.
I'm off duty, Nielsen. You hear me? I'm off duty discussing the case. Now, IA shouldn't have a problem with that.
The balding Nielsen cracks a smile.
Maybe I should put in for some overtime, huh?
Don't work too hard, Shooter. Might drive you to drink.
Nick shakes his head, then jumps up.
Stop riding me, man! I'll kick your fucking teeth in!
What's the problem?
No problem, Doctor. Here comes a shrink. I'm just in time to save her favorite patient.
Just fuck off, Martin.
You kids have a good time tonight, huh?
Beth goes over to Nick at the bar.
He's asking for it.
That's right, so don't take the bait.
He catches her gaze.
You want to go?
Yes.
He wraps his arm around her waist and they walk out.
Sometimes I think he started banging her just to get off the hook with internal affairs.
He ain't that way. He's got a heart.
Later, the couple enters Beth's dim apartment. She flicks on the lights. He shakes the rain off his jacket, then pulls it off. She hangs up her trench coat and sidles up to him. He turns to face her. They regard each other for a moment. Nick slams Beth up against a wall. Holding her arms above her head, he kisses her. She slides her tongue into his mouth. He runs his hand down the side of her body, then yanks her leg around his hip. As she leans her head back, he kisses her neck and fondles her breasts. Slipping his mouth onto hers, he devours her lips. Shining with sweat, she draws away from him and looks deeply into his eyes. He caresses her throat, then suddenly tears open her blouse. Her buttons fly. He lifts her bra up and rips it open, exposing her breasts. She kisses him passionately as he squeezes them. Then he pulls her from the wall and presses up against the opposite one, seizing her from behind. He grabs her face, kisses it. Then her hands follow his over her lean, bare stomach. She arches her hands over her head. He draws up her skirt, revealing her panties, then pushes her to a chair and shoves her over the back of it. Struggling in his grasp, she tries to rise up. He shoves her back down. Nick rips away her panties, then sucks her shoulder and straddles her from behind. He slides his hand over her face. She suckles one of his fingers. His touch grows more tender as he relaxes. Later, they lie spooned together on the floor, their clothes in disarray.
What was she like?
Who?
Catherine Tremell.
You had her pegged. She used her book as an alibi.
I met her at Berkeley.
He props himself up.
We were in some of the same classes.
Why didn't you tell me?
I'm telling you.
Sitting up, she tries to close her buttonless blouse. She slaps her thigh in exasperation.
You've never been like that before. Why?
You tell me. You're the shrink.
You weren't making love to me.
No, who's I making love to?
You weren't making love.
He runs his hand through his hair.
Said you quit.
She rises in a huff, starts for the bedroom, then turns back.
It's the top drawer of the foyer. Get it on your way out. Okay.
Pulling on his pants, he hops up. Daytime. Nick strolls into headquarters and nods to Andrews, who follows him into Walker's office.
You look like dog shit.
Nah, he looks a little shrunk, is all.
Not just in the head.
All right, I made a couple of calls to Berkeley. There was a murder in 80. A professor, in his bed, multiple stab wounds, with an ice pick.
Tremell was there then, wasn't she?
University records say she was. Okay, let's move on this. Gus, get out to Berkeley. Harrigan, find out what else she's published. Andrews, you give me that file on the parents' accident. Copy Beth on everything. I want psychological input on this one.
What about me?
Oh, you're already getting psychological input, Hoss.
You go soak your head in a tub of ice water.
Nick starts out.
Nick?
He turns back, clutching a cigarette between his fingers. Walker steps up to him.
You see where she leads.
Nick flashes a tiny smile, nods, then saunters off. Now outside the beach house. Wearing a beige jacket and pantsuit, Catherine walks through a patio door onto the driveway. She climbs into her black Lotus, a sleek, two-seated sports car. Pulling out of the front gate, she makes a left turn and speeds off. Nick, parked at the curb, quickly follows. Moments later, they drive down a twisting two-lane highway, which curves through grassy hills. Catherine shoots into the oncoming lane, crossing the solid yellow line, then speeds past a slow car and ducks back into the right lane. In his brown, unmarked sedan, Nick does the same, trying to keep up. Rounding a bend, Catherine passes another car. Nick follows in hot pursuit. Behind his sunglasses, his eyes are glued to the road as the highway curls tightly back and forth. Catherine zooms one car ahead of him. Nick zips into the opposite lane and passes it, staying on her tail. Veering around a curve, she speeds past a van. Nick tries the same move, but another car approaches, forcing him to duck back into the proper lane. On the second try, he pulls in front of the van and spots Catherine several yards ahead. She continues to charge recklessly into the opposite lane, just missing oncoming cars as she passes others. Nick stays right behind. Nearing a bend, Catherine overtakes two trucks and ducks out of sight. Unable to see any approaching vehicles behind the curve, Nick pulls out into the opposite lane and finds a bus heading straight for him. He slams on the brakes. He manages to drop back behind the trucks. The bus streaks by in the other lane. Sweat glistens on his forehead as he catches his breath. A little later, he drives into the edge of a small town, pulling ahead of the two trucks. Turning down a residential street, Nick scans the area looking for Catherine. He can't find her and presses his lips together in exasperation. Trees line the town's sleepy streets. A wooden bench with wrought iron legs sits on a sidewalk. At an intersection, he spots a white house. Catherine's black Lotus is parked in front. He quickly turns down that street and stops several yards away, out of sight from the house. It has a simple one-story layout with bushes and flowers planted in the small yard. His hard-featured face set stonily, Nick steps out and saunters toward the house, keeping his eyes peeled on the surrounding area. He opens the mailbox, reaches inside, and draws out a letter-sized manila envelope. Through the clear plastic window, an address reads, Hazel Dobkins, 26 Albion Road, Mill Valley, California. Eyeing the house, he slips the letter back inside, shuts the mailbox, and heads back to his car. At dusk, Nick, his sunglasses now removed, sits slumped behind the wheel of his parked car. Catherine steps out of the house with a middle-aged woman. They amble up to the Lotus. Keeping his eyes trained on them, Nick sits straight up. He watches Catherine kiss the woman on the cheek, then jog to her car. Catherine drives off. Nick quickly follows. Passing the older woman who stands on the sidewalk watching Catherine go, he studies her carefully. She has a bushy head of blonde hair and a lined face. The woman wraps her jacket around her, warding off a chill, then turns back to the house. Nick drives on. Moments later, as they pull into traffic, Catherine veers around a car ahead of her at an intersection. She tears through a light as it changes to red. Nick's trapped behind two cars which slow to a stop. He throws up his hands in frustration, then wipes his brow, running his fingers through his hair. Back at the beach house, the black Lotus sits in the driveway. Nick pulls up behind it and climbs out. He walks through a wooden door onto a patio facing an outdoor pool. He spies Catherine through a window in the nearby house. She stands in a second-floor room, lit by two orange-shaded lamps. She slips off her pants. Outside, wavering lights from the pool shimmer across Nick's face as he steps closer to study her. Catherine removes her jacket, revealing a scarf draped over her nude body. Sliding off the long silken drape, she exposes her small, pert breasts. Her naked skin gleams in the muted orange light. As she steps into the next room, she clicks off the lamps with a wall switch, plunging the house into darkness. Nick self-consciously backs away, closing the patio door behind him. Later at headquarters, words appear on a computer screen. Hazel Dobkins, Mill Valley. In the empty office, Nick sits at his desk, typing on the keyboard. A note appears on his computer screen. Nothing current. The computer begins to search. A second note appears. Released San Quentin, July 7th, 1965. With a quiet snicker, he types in prior arrest record, then takes a sip from a coffee mug as he waits. The computer responds, homicide, January 10th, 1956, San Francisco. Smoke swirls up from an ashtray as Gus enters and pats Nick's shoulder.
Ain't you got nothing better to do than come in here and jack off the damn machine?
What are you doing here, cowboy?
Came in here to jack off the damn machine. One dead psychology professor, Noah Goldstein, Dr. Noah Goldstein. And guess what? He was her counselor.
Was she a suspect?
No, sir. They never even got a statement from her. Hazel Dobkins.
You know her?
Couldn't get it out of my head for years. Nice little housewife, three little kids. Nice husband, wasn't porking around, no financial problems. One day, out of the clear blue sky, she does them. All of them. Used the knife she got for a wedding present. Didn't even deny it. Sweet as honey. Said she didn't know why she'd done it.
Glancing away, Nick takes a thoughtful drag on a cigarette. Daytime. Nick walks up to the beach house. As he peers through a window, Catherine opens up a side door.
Hi.
Am I disturbing you?
No, come on in. Let's go upstairs.
She drops a pile of clippings onto a desk. As he eyes them, her mouth curls into a smirk. They show photos of Nick with the headlines, Killer Cop to Face Police Review, Tourists Killed by Cop, Cop Cleared in Tourist Shooting.
I'm using you for my detective in my book. You don't mind, do you?
She slings him a sly smile, then heads upstairs.
I was just going to make myself a drink. Do you want one?
No, thanks.
Oh, that's your off the Jack Daniels, too, aren't you?
In an upstairs living room, she approaches a bar.
Got a few more questions to ask you.
I have some for you, too. For my book.
She takes a block of ice out of a refrigerator. Using a silver-handled ice pick, she expertly separates the block into jagged chunks.
Do you have something against ice cubes?
I like rough edges.
So what do you want to ask?
How's it feel to kill someone?
Her eyes lock onto his.
You tell me.
I don't know, but you do.
It was an accident. I got a line of fire.
She saunters over to him with two drinks.
Four shootings in 5 years? All accidents?
He takes a glass.
You had drug buys. I was working undercover. You want to tell me about Professor Goldstein?
Well, there's a name from the past.
You want a name from the present? What about Hazel Dobkins?
Her gaze turns icy.
Noah Goldstein was my counselor my freshman year. That's probably where I got the idea for the ice pick for my book. Funny how the subconscious works.
Hilarious.
Hazel's my friend.
Well, your friend took out her whole family.
Yes, she helped me understand homicidal impulse.
But you would have learned that at school.
Only in theory. But you know all about homicidal impulse. Don't you, Shooter?
His eyes grow wide.
Not in theory, in practice. What happened? Did you get sucked into it? Did you like it too much?
She edges closer.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Tell me about the coat, Nick. The day you shot those two tourists. How much coke did you do? Come on. You can tell me.
She brings her face up to his. Their noses brush, her lips part.
I didn't.
He Yes, you did. They never tested you, did they? Internal Affairs knew. Your wife knew too, didn't she?
She presses her hand to his chest. He grips it hard. She leans closer.
She knew what was going on. Nikki got too close to the flame.
He twists her hand behind her back, then licks his lips as their mouths almost meet.
Nikki liked it.
She closes her eyes on the verge of a kiss.
That's why she killed herself.
He pushes her away. Staring at him, her eyes shine triumphantly. His fill with a look of contempt. Roxy sashays in. Catherine turns to her with a broad smile.
Hi, hon.
She goes over to her, pulls her close, and pecks her on the lips.
You two have met, haven't you?
As the women embrace, Catherine fondles Roxy's breast. Nick glares at them for a moment, then starts for the door.
You're going to make a terrific character, Nick.
She passionately kisses Roxy on the mouth. Back at headquarters, Nick bursts into Beth's office, past a secretary in the outer area.
She's on the phone. She'll be right with you, Detective. Entrance exit. Oh, I'm going to have to give you a call back. Yeah, Detective, let me call you back. Right. Detective, you can't go in.
Who's got access to my file?
What are you talking about, Nick?
Who has access to my goddamn file?
Nobody! It's a confidential psychiatric record. It would be illegal.
Good. Don't you fucking lie to me. It's Internal Affairs, wasn't
no.
it?
No. No, Nick, please.
Who?
It's Nielsen.
Moments later, Nick strides through a bustling department and marches into an office confronting Nielsen, the detective from the bar.
What do you want, Kern?
You sold her my file, didn't you?
Who are you talking about?
Catherine Tremell. How much did she pay you?
Hey!
Officers charge in and pull Nick off Nielsen. He struggles in their grasp until one whips out a gun.
Hey! Back off! Back off, Kern!
They lead him to the door, then shove him out.
You fucked yourself, Shooter, you hear me? You are out!
Easy. Cool. Take it easy.
You are out! You're out! Okay, okay, okay.
The men restrain Nielsen. Later in the parking lot, Gus runs up to Nick.
Nick! What's going down, Hoss?
Nothing. All right, I'll be okay.
No, sir, you won't. They're going to want your badge.
I'm tired of being played with.
You got a real conclusive way of demonstrating that.
Nick sits in the driver's seat of his car.
She knows where I live and breathe. She's coming after me, Gus.
What is it you got between you?
I don't know.
Something, though.
Something. Yeah.
He pulls the car door shut. Nighttime. Nick watches TV in his apartment.
George Jefferson is unfair. He's short with no hair.
He pours himself a drink.
Nick? Nick, are you there?
Go away, Beth. I don't want to see you.
Beth unlocks the door and steps inside. She holds up a Bart Simpson key ring.
I still have my key.
Put them on the table and leave.
She stands firm.
Put it on the goddamn table and leave!
Damn it! Don't shut me out! You owe me more than that!
He picks up her key ring.
I don't owe you anything. Now, you don't owe me anything. We went to bed, what, 10-15 times maybe? It wasn't memorable enough to carry an obligation.
He rips his key off the ring.
Sometimes I really hate you.
Oh, why don't you get yourself some friendly little therapist to work out some of that hostility? And maybe you can get off once in a while.
No!
She lunges at Nick, slamming him against the wall.
You nuts!
He throws her off. She scrambles to a chair. Nick starts to pace. Beth takes an anxious swallow and stares up at him, her tousled hair hanging in her face.
Sorry. I don't usually act like that.
How could you give him my file?
I had to.
He was going to recommend your discharge from the force. He didn't buy my evaluation. He said I wasn't objective. So I made a deal with him to review the session notes himself. I didn't think he'd show them to anybody.
He did it for me.
Yes. I care about you. I did it for you.
His shoulders sag.
Go away, Ben. Please, just go away.
Nick gazes out a window, his arms crossed over his chest. She bows her head for a moment, then rises. Later that night, Nick lies asleep on the couch. A grisly horror movie plays on TV. Nick groggily holds up his head.
You.
His eyes clear gravely.
I'm on my way.
Later, Nick drives down a city street. Turning a corner, he pulls up to a crowded crime scene. Blue and red lights flash on top of parked police cruisers. Curiosity seekers fill the sidewalk. Firemen stand near a bright red engine as Nick hops out of his car. He marches past detectives and uniformed officers to the heart of the scene. Walker, his hands stuffed into his jacket pockets, eyes Nick's approach with a wary gaze. He stands near a sedan with Gus, who nods toward the open driver's seat. Nick steps closer to find Nielsen slumped over the wheel. Blood trickles from a blackened bullet wound in his temple. His sidelong stare is frozen and still. A photographer's flash pops as Nick studies the corpse. Lieutenant Walker zips up the neck of his jacket. Gus inches closer.
One shot. Close range. Probably a .38 caliber revolver.
Give me a gun, Nick.
Nick Curran shoots him a perplexed look. He pulls out his pistol and hands it to Walker. The lieutenant sniffs it.
You think that...
Nick looks to his partner. Gus shakes his head.
I don't, Hoss. But I got the minority opinion.
He leads Nick away. Later in the interrogation room.
Okay, I went after him.
I lost my temper.
Do you have any evidence that he showed your psychiatric file to anyone?
No.
Beth enters.
We'll speak with you afterwards, Dr. Garner.
I'd like to sit in if you don't mind.
I'd really rather wait until...
I don't see anything wrong with Dr. Garner sitting in if Detective Curran doesn't object.
Nick shrugs to Talcott and shakes his head. Beth takes a seat.
Where were you last night?
Home, watching TV.
All night?
Yes, all night.
Were you drinking?
Nick's eyes flit to Beth, sitting in the back of the room.
Yeah, I was drinking.
When you start drinking again?
A couple days ago.
I saw Detective Curran at his apartment about 10 o'clock last night. He was sober and lucid. I asked him in my capacity as his departmental therapist about his altercation with Lieutenant Nielsen. He expressed regret and displayed no hostility.
How long were you at his apartment?
About 15 minutes. I saw there was no reason for my concern and left.
There's no smoking in this building, Detective.
Nick puts a cigarette in his mouth.
What are you going to do, charge me with smoking?
Oh, for Christ. All right, Nick, I'm going to ask you this just once. For the record, did you kill Marty Nielsen?
Nick takes a puff.
No. Come on, I'm going to storm into his office in front of everybody in the middle of the day and kill him that night? I'm not that dumb.
Going after him before gets you off the hook for killing him. That's your alibi.
Like writing a book about killing a guy gets you off the hook for killing him.
Good point.
I don't understand. What are you talking about? What book?
Private joke, asshole.
I don't think it's funny. You're going on leave, Curran. Pending the outcome of a psychiatric evaluation.
Nick regards Beth, who looks away. Later, the detective strolls down a hallway with Walker and Gus. As they approach an elevator bank, Nick continues down the hall.
Beth! I'll get my stuff in a minute.
He runs after her.
Beth!
Thank you.
She breaks into a shy smile. He follows her down a staircase.
It's the least I could do, considering I got you into this mess with those reports.
No, I mean it. Thank you.
How do you know Catherine Trammell saw your file?
She knows things about me that I only told you.
She must really be something. From a clinical point of view.
What was she like in school?
I hardly knew her. She gave me the creeps, though. I don't know why.
As they step outside, she turns to face him.
Get some rest. Promise?
She turns away. He tugs her hand, pulling her back to his side.
Beth, I didn't mean what I said yesterday.
Yes, you did. I'm a big girl. I can handle it.
With a sweet grin, she heads to her nearby car. He watches her go with a smile, then steps back inside. Beth's grin quickly drops. She climbs into her car, her chest heaving a sigh. Inside the squad room, Nick zips up a duffel bag at his desk. Gripping the bag, he takes a file folder over to Andrews.
Hey, you take care of yourself.
What'd you find out about the parents?
You're on leave, man. You're on psycho leave. I mean, I'm talking to a possible wacko here.
Well, you know I'm wacko, Sam. What'd you find out?
The boat blew. There was a leak in the fuel line. There had been two previous repairs. They had a 5 mil policy on both of them. A real heavy investigation, but they got zilch. Big goose egg. It was an accident.
IA's going to talk to you more about Nilsson. They're handling the investigation. We're not. You stay in touch with Dr. Garner. It'll help on the evaluation.
She killed him, Phil.
Beth? Now you got Beth killing people?
Now, Catherine Trammell is part of her game.
First you got her stealing your file, now you got her killing Nilsson? Forget about her, for Christ's sake. Go somewhere, sit in the sun, get her the hell out of your system.
You don't buy it, do you? She knew nobody'd buy it. She knew I'd say she did it, and she knew that nobody would buy it.
She is screwing with your head, Nick. Stay away from her.
He shuts his office door in Curran's face. Now the city skyline looms in the distance, its skyscrapers stretching up to the clear blue sky. Nick motors down an avenue behind the wheel of his car. His sunglasses cover his eyes as he sits with a clenched jaw. Pulling up to an apartment building, he spots the Black Lotus parked at the curb. Catherine sits on the building's stoop. Glancing up, she approaches Nick's car.
I heard about what happened.
He parks and climbs out, carrying his sports bag. She flashes a coy smile.
What good's a shooter without his gun?
How exactly did you find out?
I have attorneys. They have friends. I have friends. Money buys a lot of attorneys and friends.
Well, I wouldn't know about that. I don't have any money. I don't have any attorneys, and Gus is my only real friend.
I wasn't talking about real friends.
They pause in front of the stoop, their eyes lock.
Why doesn't Gus like me?
I like you.
You do?
Yes. You want to go upstairs and have a drink?
I didn't think you'd ask me.
I guess you don't know your character that well.
Maybe. But I'm learning. Pretty soon I'll know you better than you know yourself.
Don't be so sure.
Why not?
I'm very unpredictable.
They enter his apartment. She studies the simple furnishings.
You ought to put some warmth into the place. You don't want to reflect on your personality.
I'm not trying to fool anybody. Jack Daniel's all right. It's going to have to be. Ice?
Yeah, great.
He takes out a block of ice, sets it on the kitchen counter, then pulls out a cheap-looking ice pick from a drawer.
I was expecting you.
She grins. He slices off tiny chips of ice.
Kmart. $1.65.
Stepping behind him, she wraps her hand around his.
Why don't you let me do this for you?
He turns away, releasing the pick. She gets a better grip on it, then deftly breaks the ice into pieces.
You like watching me do it, don't you?
Nick takes out a cigarette and lights it.
Could I have a cigarette too, please? See, I told you you'd start smoking again. Would you light it for me?
He takes his own cigarette out of his mouth and places it in hers. She takes a drag.
Thanks.
So how much you pay Nilsson for my file?
Isn't he the policeman that you shot, shooter?
What have I
ask you not to call me Shooter.
Okay. How about if I call you Nikki?
My wife used to call me Nikki.
Yeah, I know. I like it.
She puts the ice in two glasses and hands one to him.
Cheers. My friends call me Catherine.
What Manny Vasquez used to call you?
Bitch, mostly. But he meant it affectionately. Do you have any Coke? I just love Coke with Jack Daniels.
Got a Pepsi in the fridge.
Oh, it's not really the same thing now, is it?
No, it's not. So where's this going? What do you want from me?
She inches closer.
Say, what do you want from me, Catherine?
What the fuck do you want from me, Catherine?
As they look deeply into each other's eyes, a cunning smile plays across her face. She steps past him.
I brought you something.
She hands him a paperback novel. The title reads, The First Time by Catherine Wolfe.
Aren't you going to say thank you?
Well, what's it about?
It's about a boy who kills his parents. They have a play and he makes it look like an accident.
He studies her carefully for a moment.
Why'd he do that?
To see if he could get away with it.
When'd you write this?
You mean, did I write it before my parents died?
Yeah.
No. I wrote it years afterwards. You're not going to stop following me around now, are you, just because you're on leave?
Absolutely not.
They walk to the door.
Good, I'd miss you. You could get in trouble, though. You're not really a cop anymore.
I'll risk it.
Why take the risk?
To see if I can get away with it.
She starts down the steps.
How's your new book?
It's practically writing itself. Oh, I'll be leaving about midnight, in case you are going to follow me. I'll be at Johnny Boz's club.
I'll meet you there.
She passes Gus on his way up.
Hi, Gus.
A stunned look washes over his face. He watches her sashay off, then stares up at Nick, who waves. Moments later, from his apartment window, Nick watches Catherine climb into her Lotus and drive off. Gus enters with a box of pizza.
Forgive me for asking, Hoss, and I don't mean to belabor the obvious. But why is it you got your head so far up your own ass?
You want to play? Fine. I can play.
Everybody she plays with dies.
I know what that's like.
Now a packed nightclub inside a renovated church. Neon-lit arches line the dim, smoky room. Muted saints and stained glass windows adorn the walls. Yellow lights throb over the crowded dance floor as multi-ethnic clubgoers sway to the music. One woman sports a bright pink mohawk. A muscle-bound bartender dressed as a priest serves up a drink. We scan over the cosmopolitan crowd, then drop down toward the dance floor as Nick enters. He wears jeans and a V-neck sweater without a shirt. Searching the crowd, he spots Roxy dancing provocatively with another woman. She wears a low-cut top and tiny black shorts. Nick stops to watch her. Roxy strokes the woman on the cheek, then walks away. Nick follows her into the men's room. Inside, a gender-bending couple lick tongues, while others, male and female, smoke and mill about. Roxy approaches one of the stalls. Inside, Catherine sits on the toilet, wiping her nose while a drug dealer grins beside her. Roxy settles onto her lap. The dealer spoons out cocaine from a vial and holds it out to Roxy. Looking up, Catherine spies Nick watching them. She smiles slyly. He takes a step closer. She kicks the stall door closed. Later, on the dance floor, Roxy and Catherine work up a sweat with a mustached drug dealer. Roxy spins around as the man takes Catherine into his arms. Behind them, Roxy throws her arms into the air, thrusting from side to side. Catherine turns to face her. Nick makes his way through the crowd, sipping a drink. Catherine and Roxy dance closely together. Placing her hands on Roxy's cheeks, Catherine draws her partner into a kiss. Nick approaches them with a determined gaze. Catherine, wearing a sparkling gold dress with an open back, spots him and turns her back to Roxy. As they grind back to front, Roxy fondles Catherine's breasts. Catherine steps away and dances with Nick. Roxy throws up her hand with a jealous sneer. Nick tries to kiss Catherine. She spins away from him. Nick nods, stoically standing in place. Catherine steps closer, then grinds her tight, round ass into his groin. She watches Roxy, who throws her a stern look while dancing with the drug dealer. Catherine turns to face Nick with a satisfied smile. His eyes flip from Roxy back to Catherine, whose expression glimmers in delight. Nick grips her ass. He pulls her in and they begin to sway together. Spotlights pulse as their noses slide against each other. Roxy, pumping from side to side to the beat, watches. Nick's mouth trails down Catherine's cheek to her neck, then back up to her chin. He tenderly kisses her lips, then pulls back. They eye each other for a moment, then melt into a soft, brushing kiss. Roxy continues to gyrate, holding her hands in the air. She watches Catherine kiss Nick passionately while pulling and rubbing his sweater and neck. Their lips devour each other amid the throbbing crowd. Later, Nick lays Catherine onto a bed and plunges his mouth onto hers. Kicking off his jeans, his naked ass straddles her. Then he sits up and pulls his sweater off his muscular chest. She lies beneath him, naked, her nipples erect. Her chest heaves a sigh as he bends over and licks her breast. She writhes under him. He wraps his hands around her breasts and hungrily sucks on them. She caresses his head and squirms with pleasure. His mouth moves down her body from her breast to her belly, then toward her groin. She arches her back. Nick, kneeling on the floor, glances up at her. Catherine tightly grips her discarded dress behind her neck with both hands. He stares down at her. Placing her leg on his shoulder, he kisses the inside of her thigh, then takes a peek at her face. She starts to rock on the bed, jutting her breasts, her eyes cloud in ecstasy. Later, she lies on top of him. Resting on a pillow, he grips the brass bars of the headboard. Catherine ravishes his mouth with her tongue. She moves down his chest to suck and lick his nipple. He grips the sides of her head as she moves further down. He gazes up at a full-length ceiling mirror. In their reflection, Catherine's head covers Nick's groin. On the bed, he twists from side to side, then raises his head to gaze down at her. She brings her mouth up to his. Kissing her, Nick rolls on top. He grips her hands, pins them to the pillow above her head, then thrusts deeply. Writhing beneath him, she slaps the headboard. He kisses her again, then slips his right hand fingers into his mouth. He licks them for a moment, then slides them into her mouth. She sucks hard. He greedily envelops her mouth and thrusts forward. She squirms and arches her body. She grabs the headboard, shaking it. Releasing the bars, her fingers claw his back, drawing blood. He rears up in pain. She raises her head, breathing against him, mouth to mouth. They roll over again. She sits up, straddling him. He tries to suck on her breasts. She pushes him down, grabs his wrists, and places his hands on the pillow above his head. He trembles beneath her as she keeps his arms pinned. She slides her hand under the pillow and slowly pulls out a long white silk scarf. He eyes it warily. Gazing at him, she bunches it together, feeling the fabric with her fingers. Catherine places it behind his head. She ties his right hand to a brass bar, then his left. He tries to nibble her arms while she tightly knots the scarf. His fettered hands stretch open, then ball into fists. Sitting on top of him, she rocks savagely. Nick tenses. his arm straining against the scarf. Catherine slides her hand down his leg and slips it across the sheet. Suddenly, she flings herself forward onto his chest. Her hands are empty. She unties his left hand, then his right, her sweaty hair hanging in his face. As she straddles him, he places his hands on her thighs and caresses her skin. Sitting up, he holds her close. They rock together gently. As his head rests on her breasts, she gazes into the distance with a deep sighing shiver. Later, they lie beneath the sheets. Moonlight filters in through an open window. Nick takes a drag from a cigarette. Smoke curls up from his hand. He places the cigarette in an ashtray on the night table. As he rises, Catherine turns over. Nick struts into the bathroom, exposing his square build and bare ass. He bends over the sink, rinses his mouth, and splashes his face. Standing up, he gazes into the mirror to find Roxy's leather-jacketed reflection behind him.
If you don't leave her alone, I'll kill you.
He towels off his face.
Let me ask you something, Rocky. Man to man.
She eyes him coldly.
I think she's the fuck of the century.
Her mouth falls open, restraining.
What do you think?
She steps closer. He leans into her face.
How long you been here? You like watching, don't you?
She likes me to watch.
Her eyes lock onto his with a merciless stare. Returning her gaze, Nick nods. Roxy turns away and struts into an adjoining room. Nick heads back into the bedroom. He slides beneath the sheets beside Catherine. Lamplight throws a soft glow onto their skin. As he places his hand on her waist, she takes hold of it, brings it up to her lips, and kisses his palm.
Nicky.
Nick's mouth dissolves into a contented smile. He rests his head on the pillow next to hers. Morning. Nick sleeps alone in Catherine's bed. Claw marks cover his sweaty back. Suddenly, he rears up. Wiping his eyes, he looks around to find a note lying on Catherine's pillow. It reads, "The beach. C." He crumples the note in his fist. Later, Nick's Mustang pulls up to the entrance of the beach house, and he climbs out. On the stone stairway behind the house, Catherine paces beside Roxy. Nick approaches. Catherine glances up at him, then starts down the steps. Roxy climbs up to Nick. She glowers as he swaggers past.
Hi.
Roxy saunters toward the house. Nick continues down the steps. He meets up with Catherine at a clearing overlooking the beach. A fire burns in an open pit. Staring into the flames, Catherine holds a shawl tightly around her. Nick comes up behind her and draws her into a tender kiss.
Good morning. Guess Roxy's not taking this too well, huh?
She's seen me fuck plenty of guys.
Maybe she saw something she's never seen before.
She's seen everything before.
Honey, I thought I'd seen everything before.
Did you really think it was so special?
I told her I thought it was the fuck of the century.
He follows her down to the beach.
Well, what do you think?
I thought it was a pretty good beginning.
What about Roxy? Is she more fun?
Would you like her to join us sometime?
Did she join you and Johnny?
No, Johnny felt intimidated.
Look what happened to him.
Tell me, Nicky, were you frightened last night?
That's the point, wasn't it? That's what made it so good.
You shouldn't play this game.
Why not? I like it.
You're in over your head.
Maybe. But this is how I'll catch my killer.
She breaks into a cryptic smile.
Not gonna confess all my secrets, Nick, just because I have an orgasm. You won't learn anything I don't want you to know.
Yes,
Yes, I will. And I'll nail you.
No. You'll just fall in love with me.
I'm in love with you already.
He gives her a kiss.
But I'll nail you anyway. You can put that in your book.
Pointing at her, he starts up the beach. She pulls the shawl tighter. Nighttime at a country and western bar. As a band plays on stage, couples dance and twirl on the crowded floor. Stepping up to the bar, Nick taps a cowboy on the shoulder. It's Gus, wearing a suede jacket and 10-gallon hat.
Thought I'd find you here.
Where the fuck you been? I've been over to your place.
Easy, cowboy. Wasn't there.
I went over last night, too.
Well, I wasn't there either.
Nick puts on Gus's hat and holds his former partner's gaze.
You fucked. Goddamn dumb son of a bitch, you fucked her! Goddamn, you are one dumb son of a bitch!
Next time I use a rubber.
I don't give a flying chili bean fart about rubber!
Moments later, they pass a group of middle-aged women in the parking lot.
I'm worried about him, he's worried about rubbers.
You gotta protect yourself, Gus, you really do.
Well, what the hell for? You think I'm getting any? I mean, sure I can get laid by goddamn blue-haired women. I don't like them.
Don't talk until you tried it.
They head toward a diner. A little later, Nick watches Gus eat a bowl of chili.
Feeling better?
I feel fine. How could you fuck her?
Gotta squat.
Patrons in a nearby booth glare at them.
You want to die, Hoss? What is it, those goddamn tourists? You still feel so bad about that, you're wiggling your way into an ice pick? Got too many goddamn tourists coming here anyway. Plenty more goddamn tourists where they goddamn came from.
He sprinkles hot sauce into his bowl, then stirs it around. Seated across from Gus, Nick gazes out the window.
I'm not afraid of her.
Why the hell not?
I don't know. I'm just not.
That's her pussy talking. It ain't your brain.
Yes, come on.
Gus jiggles his tongue at a glaring woman nearby. She rolls her eyes.
IA done did a track on Lieutenant Martin D for dickhead nursing. They found a safety deposit box with $50,000 in it, taken out 3 months ago and not used since.
It doesn't make any sense. She didn't know me 3 months ago.
Maybe it wasn't her that paid it. Maybe the money was for something else. How the fuck do I know? I'm just an old city cowboy trying not to fall out of his saddle.
Nick stares pensively out the window. Later, the two men leave the diner. Through a windshield in a car parked across the street, we watch Gus take out a piece of gum and stuff it into his mouth.
You all right, cowboy?
Yep.
Yeah. Come on, I'm gonna drive you home.
My little piss-ant car of yours. Hell no. I ain't getting no back pain disability retirement. I'm gonna get me a full pension and a real gold-plated Seiko watch.
Move or I'm driving.
Hey, you about to let you drive my car? I ain't gonna let no head-up-his-ass person drive my car.
Gus drives off in his Cadillac. With a toothpick clenched between his teeth, Nick smiles after his friend. Heading away from the diner, he throws the pick onto the ground. Behind him, Catherine's black Lotus slowly creeps out of a parking space. Nick saunters down an alleyway, unaware the car is following. The headlights are off, and it's too dark to see the driver. Picking up speed, the car heads straight for him. Nick jumps and bounces off the hood. He crashes onto the pavement, unhurt. The Lotus brakes, then starts spinning in reverse. Nick tumbles out of its path just in time. As he gets to his feet, the car shifts into forward and speeds off. Nick climbs into his red Mustang and tears after the Lotus. Gripping the wheel, he shakes his head to regain his senses. The Lotus makes a sharp turn and veers into a narrow alley. The Mustang follows, bucking over large humps in the middle of the road. The Lotus races up a sloping street. As the Mustang pulls out of the alley, nearly colliding into a truck, it slams onto a sidewalk staircase. Regaining control, Nick smashes into a flower box, then starts to drive up the stairs, lurching up landing after landing. Reaching the top, he knocks a street sign over. The Mustang swerves around the truck and speeds up a sloping street. Nick reaches the crest of the hill and soars over it. Sparks fly as the cars skid down the other side. Nick makes a hard turn onto a flatter street and zooms after the Lotus. Both cars head into a construction area with bright lights and blockades bordering either side. Nick turns a corner onto a long overpass and finds the Lotus waiting for him at the other end. Nick picks up speed and the two cars close head on.
You want to play hot? Come on!
The Lotus swerves into another lane.
Come on!
Nick does the same. The Lotus veers back into its original lane. Nick does too, still on a collision course. Just as the cars are about to crash, the Lotus swerves out of Nick's path, smashes through blockades, and nosedives into a construction pit. Metal and glass fly through the air as the Lotus lands upside down. Hopping out of his car, Nick runs to the edge. He knocks a blockade over and bolts downhill, sliding down the steep slope. Reaching the bottom, he steps up to the Lotus. A blonde-haired woman lies face down halfway out of the car. He crouches down beside her and turns her over.
Roxy.
Roxy's eyes gaze skyward. Tightening his jaw, Nick stares into the distance. Later, a winch hauls the Lotus out of the pit. Rescue workers place Roxy's limp body onto a stretcher. Walker heads toward Nick, who stands near other detectives. Halfway up the slope, Andrews gazes down at his boss.
Lieutenant! I got the information!
Well, I'll get it down here! This is your statement? You signed your name to this crack of
shit? Why not? It was an accident.
You're driving around North Beach for no particular reason, and this car won't get out of the way.
I don't think she meant to go off the edge, do you?
Can we have him for a minute here?
No, you cannot!
Don't fuck with me on this, Nick. I don't need reason to put your ass in a sling.
Full name is Roxanne Hardy. Last known address, Cloverdale, California. No priors, no convictions. Car is registered to Catherine Trammell.
You knew her, didn't you?
Yes, and I met at Trammell's house. All we did is write her name down.
You wrote her name down, and then, big surprise, she rolls her car down the hill in front of you and dies. Is that what you're telling me?
That's all I know.
Well, you know what, then? Fuck you, Nick. Fuck you!
I want you at Dr. Garner's office at 9.
I told you to stay away from Trammell.
You didn't tell me to stay away from the car!
I said I want you at Dr. Garner's office at 9 o'clock.
Who are you guys going to sell my file to now, huh?
You are out of control, Curran. You hear me?
Nearby, the rescue workers lift Roxy out of the pit. Daytime. Nick enters a conference room to meet Beth and two middle-aged men.
Hello, Nick. It's Dr. Myron and Dr. McElwain.
Nick?
They've been asked to consult with me on a psychiatric evaluation.
Sit down, Nick.
Curran takes a seat at the table and crosses his legs.
Nick, we understand you've been having some difficulty controlling your temper lately. Only in regard to one person. Do you think Lieutenant Nielsen deserved to die?
I didn't know him well enough. I won't miss him.
Nick, when you recollect your childhood, are your recollections pleasing to you?
Number one. I don't remember how often I used to jerk off, but it was a lot. Number two, I wasn't pissed off my dad, even when I was old enough to know what he and Mom were doing in the bedroom. Number three, I don't look in the toilet before I flush it. Number four, I haven't wet my bed for a long time. Number five, why don't the two of you go fuck yourselves? I'm out of here.
Nick walks to the door. Beth jumps up. As he marches out of the room, she follows him into the corridor.
What is your problem? I'm trying to help you. Why won't you let me help you?
I don't want your help, all right? I don't need your help.
Yes, you do. Something's going on. You're sleeping with her, aren't you?
What's this interest you've got in her?
My interest is in you, not her. She seduces people. She manipulates people. She'll do anything she can.
I thought you hardly knew her.
I know the type. I'm a psychologist.
That means you manipulate people too, Beth. You're a practicing psychologist. You're better at it than she is.
I feel sorry for you, Nick.
Her lips purse in a scowl. As he walks away, Beth strides back down the corridor. Later, Nick drives along a coastal highway. The road twists and turns, skirting along the edge of a sheer rock face. Below, the sea pounds against rocks and crags. A little later, Nick pulls up to Catherine's beach house. Through the frosted glass front door, we watch him climb out of his Mustang and approach. He opens the door and steps inside.
Catherine!
Nick glances around the empty foyer. Moments later, he enters a living room dappled with sunlight. Facing a large window, Catherine sits in a rocking chair, wrapped protectively in a blanket. Tears stain her cheeks. Nick walks over and sits beside her.
I should have known. Came into the house and we were down on the beach. She looked at me so strangely. She left right after you. I shouldn't have let her watch us. She wanted to watch me all the time.
She shuts her eyes for a moment, then turns to face him.
She tried to kill you, didn't she?
Did you like her to watch you?
Do you think I told her to kill you?
No.
Everybody that I care about dies.
Dropping to his knees, he inches closer and takes her into his arms. As he kisses her forehead, she lays her head on his chest. He strokes her face and whispers to her. Catherine raises her head to gaze into his eyes.
Nick loved me.
Later, they lie on the floor naked beneath her blanket. Flames flicker in the nearby fireplace, flinging shadows onto the walls and throwing an orange glow. Catherine kisses Nick and settles beside him with a contented smile. She rests her head on his shoulder.
You think she killed Johnny Bounce?
For what? To set me up? She loved me. She wouldn't frame me.
Maybe she got jealous of Johnny, too.
Well, she didn't. She never got jealous before. She got excited. I don't have luck with women. There was this girl I met when I was in college. I slept with her once. She started following me around, taking my picture. She dyed her hair, copied my clothes. Lisa. Something. Oberman. It was awful.
I thought you didn't make confessions.
She looks into his eyes.
I never did before.
He searches her face. Later, at a police station, Gus and a female officer show Nick mugshots of a teenaged Roxy. They're labeled Cloverdale Police Department.
Another nice girl.
Nick throws a glance at Gus, who leans against a shelf behind him. The officer hands Nick photographs of two young boys. Each photo shows a closer angle. The boys lie on a pile of hay face up. Their throats have been cut and drip with blood. The dead boys stare at the sky wide-eyed.
How old was she when it happened?
16. We seal juvenile records until they're deceased. That's why you couldn't find it in your computer.
What was the motive?
She said she didn't know herself, just sort of did it on impulse. The razor just happened to be there. That's what she said.
A little later, the three enter the main office.
If you want, help yourself to some coffee.
Thanks.
I don't understand what the hell is going on here, Gus.
Ain't that hard, Hoss. This young farm girl got tired of all that attention going to her little brothers, so she fixed them. Just like old Hazel Dobkins fixed her old family. Except young Roxy here didn't use a wedding present. She used Daddy's razor.
He takes a sip of coffee, then frowns.
Oof.
He throws the paper cup away, and they step out to the parking lot.
Sure makes you wonder what they talked about when they set themselves down in front of the campfire at night. You ever met a friend of hers hasn't killed somebody? Must have beat your ordinary everyday girl talk.
I'm not sure anymore she did it.
Which one are we talking about now, Hoss? We know old Hazel did it. We know young Roxy did it. And the other one. Well, she got that magna cum laude pussy on her that done fried up your brain.
Gus turns away, heading for his car. Leaning against his Mustang, Nick takes out a small black notepad. He flips to a page reading Lisa Obermann, Berkeley, 1983. At a university office, Nick leans against a counter while a registrar searches computer files.
Obermann, Mark W., Donald M. Sorry, no Lisa. You sure about the year?
Catherine Chamel graduated in 83, yeah. She said Lisa Obermann was here at the same time.
Yeah, we have Trammell. But no Lisa Obermann.
Are you sure about that? There can't be a mistake.
Only if you're making it, detective.
Later, Nick drives through the city to Catherine's townhouse. As he pulls up to her street, he finds her strolling down the sidewalk with a middle-aged Hazel. He gets out.
Hi. Hazel, this is Nick. I told you all about him. Nick, this is Hazel Dobkins.
You're the shooter, aren't you? Well, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Can I speak to you for a minute, please?
Honey, would you wait for me in the car?
I'll be right there. Goodbye, shooter.
Nick lights a cigarette.
You like to hang out with murderers or what? You know that Roxy was...
Yes, of course I knew. Look, I write about unusual people, and sometimes when I do my research, I get involved with them. It happened with you. Killing isn't like smoking. You can quit. I'm gonna go. I promised I'd get her home by 6 o'clock. She just loves America's Most Wanted.
There was no Lisa Obermann when you were at Berkeley.
What are you doing? Checking up on me? For what? I said Hoberman.
Later, Luke talks into a payphone.
Hoberman. Lisa Hoberman with an H. You do. All right, thank you very much.
At headquarters, Nick and Andrew search through motor vehicle computer files.
You know, I can get my butt kicked for this. You're not even supposed to be here.
Come on, Sam. It's only going to take a minute.
Andrews types in Lisa Hoberman. The computer replies, 1987 renewal under the name Elizabeth Garner.
Bring it up.
The screen displays Beth's driver's license.
It's Dr. Garner, isn't it?
Bring up 83.
The computer screen shows an earlier license under the name Lisa Hoberman, with a photo of a blonde-haired Beth. Andrews flicks back and forth between the two pictures. Later, Beth enters her apartment.
You shouldn't leave your door open.
Nick stands near a window.
I didn't. There's something wrong with my lock. What do you want, Nick?
Tell me about Catherine.
She stops short.
She told you, didn't she?
What'd she tell me, Beth?
I slept with her once in school. I was just a kid. I was experimenting. It was just that one time. She developed a fixation on me. She styled her hair like mine. She wore the same kind of clothes I did. It scared me. Isn't that what she told you?
She said it was you. You dressed like her. You dyed your hair blonde.
I did dye my hair. It had nothing to do with her. I was a redhead for a while,
too. Did you know Noah Goldstein?
I had him for two classes.
You saw all the reports, Beth. Phil copied you. You never said anything.
Well, what am I supposed to say? Hey, guys, I'm not gay, but I did fuck your suspect. I was embarrassed. It was the only time I've been with a woman. She's really sick, you know. Do you know what she's doing? She knows I went to Berkeley. She knows I knew Noah. She makes up this story about me. She's handing you somebody who's obsessed with her.
She didn't hand you to me. She doesn't even know who you are. She told me about a Lisa Hoberman.
She knows you'd find out who Lisa Hoberman is. You're a good cop. She tell you casually? Make it seem irrelevant? I mean, did she tell you in Bednick? It's what I do.
He looks away, shaking his head slightly.
Why'd you change your name?
I got married. He called me Beth. He was on staff at the clinic down in Salinas. Didn't last long.
He heads out.
Nick? God, I mean, do you really think that I could kill someone? I mean, I never even met Johnny Boz. And what about Nilsson? What possible motive would I have to kill Nilsson?
Get that lock fixed.
God! She's evil! She's brilliant!
Nighttime. Nick drives down a darkened street to his apartment building. He parks at the curb and climbs out. Stepping into the vestibule, he takes out a set of keys and unlocks the mailbox. He peeks inside. There's nothing there. An unseen woman comes up behind him and lays her hand on his shoulder. He spins around. It's Catherine.
Did I scare you? I wanted to surprise you. What's wrong?
I found Lisa Hoberman.
Well, you did. What's she doing?
He starts up the steps.
Are you not going to tell me what she's doing? I thought we were done playing games.
I did, too. She said you got it backwards. She said you even styled your hair like she did.
And you believed her. I had to go down to the campus police and file a report about her. I suppose you still think I kill people, too.
Daytime. In a storage room, Nick walks past shelves of boxes with a campus cop.
So who'd you say you're with?
Homicide, San Francisco.
They stop in front of a shelf.
Here we go. Kind of. There was a report about Elisa Hoberman January 1980, but it's out of here.
Who's got it?
One of your guys. Nilsson. You know?
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Tell him to bring it back. He's had it a whole year.
Later.
So Nilsson had a report on Beth. So what? You don't know what the hell was in it.
Catherine told me what was in it.
If she's telling you the truth.
Oh, Gus, don't you get it? If Beth killed Johnny Boz to frame Catherine, she wouldn't want anybody to know what happened in Berkeley. But Nilsson found out about it. And that gives her the motive to kill him.
Well, how did she know Nilsson found out if it happened?
He was IA. He probably asked her.
She'd have to be nuttier than a 20-pound Christmas fruitcake. She's not the one who hangs out with multiple murderers. Your girlfriend is.
She's a writer, all right? That's her job.
I don't buy it. There's got to be somebody at Berkeley who knows what the hell happened.
I know what happened, all right? Catherine told me. And everything she says is checked out.
You got goddamn Tweety birds fluttering around your head. That's what you got. You think you can fuck like minks, raise rugrats, and live happily ever after? Oh, man.
Nick marches off. Later, he walks up the staircase to his apartment. Reaching for his keys, he discovers the door is unlocked. He finds Catherine with a large palm tree.
How'd you get in here? What's this?
I decided to give you a second chance. I missed you.
I wasn't gone long enough for you to miss me.
Did you miss me?
No.
Catherine steps up behind him.
No?
She fondles his ass.
Why don't you come over here and tell me now?
Backing away, she slips off her blouse, revealing her breasts.
I've seen him before.
Yeah? Well, you might not see him again. My book's nearly finished. And my detective's almost dead.
So I got time for a last cigarette.
Afterwards.
Squeezing her breasts, he kisses her passionately. Later, they sit nude in a window seat. His legs are wrapped around her.
Gotta do some research tomorrow morning.
I'm good at research. I'll help you.
No, thanks.
What are you researching?
New ending to your book.
Oh, really? What's the twist?
The detective falls for the wrong girl.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't die.
So what happens to him?
They fuck like minks, raise rugrats, and live happily ever after.
It won't sell.
Why not?
Somebody has to die.
Why?
Somebody always does.
Daytime. The Mustang pulls up to a one-story building. A sign above the entrance reads, Salinas Medical Center. Nick parks and climbs out. Inside, he approaches a nurse's station in the reception area.
Good morning. I'm looking for Dr. Garner.
Oh, she doesn't work here anymore. I think she's up in San Francisco with the police.
Actually, I'm looking for her husband. He works here too, doesn't he?
Dr. Joseph Garner?
Yeah.
Is she married?
Well, you know him.
He died about 5 or 6 years ago.
How did he die?
He was shot.
Nick looks keenly away.
Thank you.
Later, he watches a sheriff hose down his car.
He was walking home from work. They only lived a couple of blocks away from the clinic. Somebody just drove by and shot him.
What was the murder weapon?
Revolver, 38. Unrecovered. Watch yourself.
Are there any suspects?
No suspects. No motive. Unsolved.
Was his wife ever a suspect?
You know, one of your guys was down here from Frisco about a year ago, and he was asking the same exact thing. You mind telling me what the hell is going on?
Routine?
Yeah. That's exactly what he said. Now, I got two of you guys coming down here telling me it's routine.
You remember what the other guy's name was?
No. Can't really say that I do.
Nielsen?
Nielsen, yeah, that was it.
So was she ever a suspect?
Nope. There was some talk, but it never panned out.
What kind of talk?
Girlfriend?
What, he had a girlfriend?
No. She did. But like I said, it never panned out.
Nick stamps out his cigarette.
Thank you.
Yeah, hope to help you out.
Yes, you did. You sure did.
At the beach house.
Catherine!
Entering her empty office, Nick finds two layouts for a book cover. One is blue, the other red. Both read, Shooter, by Catherine Wolfe. He sets them down on the desk, then turns to a printer which spits out pages. A fragment of the printout reads, Shooter raced into the staircase. Partner's dead body, legs sticking out. Catherine enters, eyeing him warily.
Hi. Missed you. Huh. I finished my research.
I finished my book.
Yeah? So how does it end?
I told you. She kills him.
He tries to hold her, but she pulls away.
Goodbye, Nick.
Goodbye?
Yeah, I finished my book. Didn't you hear me? Your character's dead. Goodbye.
She rips the pages out of the printer.
What do you want, flowers? I'll send you an autographed copy.
What is this, some kind of joke?
She stares impassively, then sorts through the sheets of paper.
You playing a game here?
The games are over. You were right. It was the fuck of the century. Shooter.
She holds his gaze boldly.
Catherine?
Hazel enters, pausing in the doorway. Nick turns toward her. The older woman flashes a patient smile.
I'll be right there.
Catherine walks up to her, places a hand on Hazel's shoulder, then starts up a nearby staircase. With a nod to Nick, Hazel follows her. He stares after them, his jaw clenching. At dusk, Nick leans against his car parked in a lot. Gripping a cigarette in his hand, he takes a drag, then stamps it out as Gus pulls up in his Cadillac.
Catherine, Tramiel's roommate freshman year. I just got a call from her. She's over in Oakland. Come on.
Nick jumps in.
I've been phoning people from her dorm all day. She must have heard I was trying to reach her. She says she knows all about Catherine and Lisa Hoberman.
Nick stares straight ahead.
You feeling okay?
Yeah.
Here's something else. Johnny Boz's psychiatrist has an office on Van Ness. Guess who he shares office space with? Dr. Elizabeth Garner.
Nick continues to stare blankly.
What in the hell's the matter with you?
Nick eyes Gus for a moment, then gazes out his window. Later, the car drives up to a tall building on an Oakland street. Gus parks and opens his door.
I'll be in suite 405.
Nick steps out, too.
Where the hell are you going?
Going with you.
You're on leave, Hoss. It ain't gonna take long.
Gus trots toward the building. Watching him, Nick climbs back into the front seat. As Gus crosses the street and approaches the entrance, a traffic light changes from green to yellow. He steps through the front door. A sign above the entryway reads 2201 Broadway. Inside, Gus walks past a deserted reception area to an elevator bank. He steps into an open elevator and presses a button marked 4. The doors close. The elevator climbs to the second floor. It stops and the doors open. Gus peeks out into the hallway. There's no one there. He steps back inside as the doors close. Gus rocks impatiently as the elevator climbs to the next floor. The indicator light flashes 3. The light bounces off the wood-paneled walls and glows amber on his face. The doors open. No one is waiting. The doors shut. Outside, Nick sits in the car. Gazing through the windshield, he looks up at the building. The fourth-floor windows show a row of empty offices. Nick's eyes widen in realization.
Gus!
Nick leaps out of the car. Inside, Gus's elevator climbs to the fourth floor. In the lobby, Nick enters in time to see the elevator light shift to 4. He makes a beeline for the stairs. Gus steps out of the elevator. A woman shrouded in a black raincoat suddenly appears and stabs him with an ice pick. Nick races up the steps. Blood drips from the unknown woman's hand as she repeatedly jams the ice pick into Gus's neck. Nick bursts through the stairwell door. Gus's legs stick out of the open elevator. Rushing over, Nick kneels down beside him. Gus struggles to speak, his neck and chest drenched with blood. Nick tries to plug a gushing artery with his finger. Gus grows still. His face turns ashen. Nick stares woefully at his friend. At the sudden noise, Nick turns. He pulls Gus's weapon out of its holster, then runs into the hallway. He steps into an adjacent corridor and finds Beth, who wears a trench coat.
Freeze!
What are you doing here?
Put your fucking hands up!
I got a message on my machine to meet Gus here. Where is he?
Don't move! Don't you move! I know about your husband. You still like girls, Beth?
What?
She reaches into her pocket.
Take your hand out of your pocket! Take him out!
What's wrong with you?
Take him out!
He shoots her. She collapses onto the floor. Lowering the gun, Nick carefully approaches. His forehead is sweaty and creased. Beth lies face up at his feet. Blood stains her trench coat as she gazes up at him.
I loved you.
Looking away, she falls still. Nick bends down and searches through her trench coat pocket. He pulls out her Bart Simpson key ring. Bowing his head, he clenches the ring in a tight fist. Later, detectives and uniformed cops mill about the corridor. Walker steps out of the elevator. In the hallway, paramedics prepare a gurney as examiners kneel beside Beth's body. Walker approaches Nick, who sits on the floor, his back against a wall.
What made you think she had a gun? What the hell was she doing here? What was Gus doing here? Nick.
Lieutenant.
Andrews enters from the stairwell. He beckons toward the steps. Rising, Walker leaves Nick's side to follow him. On the stairs, Detective Harrigan, wearing plastic gloves, picks up a blonde wig, a black raincoat, and an ice pick. He shows them to Walker. The lieutenant's eyes widen in disbelief. Andrews opens a plastic bag. Harrigan places the bloody ice pick inside, then holds out the raincoat, showing its yellow initials, SFPD.
One of ours.
Walker shakes his head.
Jesus. We have to check Beth's apartment.
At Beth's, Andrews holds up a pistol.
.38 caliber revolver in the bookcase behind some books.
Walker shoots a glance at Nick.
Have ballistics checking for Nelson.
Lieutenant, you better come in here.
Walker follows Harrigan into the kitchen. Inside, a detective opens a drawer and shows him paperback copies of two of Catherine's novels, The First Time and Love Hurts. The lieutenant also takes out magazine clippings of Catherine with Johnny Boz at parties and posing with a boxer, Manny Vasquez, inside the ring. Nick comes up behind him. Walker shows him the articles.
I guess that's it.
Among the clippings, Nick finds a graduation photo of the entire class. In a close-up, a brown-haired Beth stands behind Catherine, eyeing her. Back at headquarters, Talcott gives a press conference in Walker's office. The lieutenant steps out into the squad room as a detective holds out the raincoat.
Dr. Elizabeth Garner.
We checked. It's her size.
She must have heard you on the stairway and dumped this stuff.
There's no suite 405 in that building. Catherine Trammell's roommate her freshman year is dead. She died of leukemia 2 years ago. Okay, here's the facts of a death certificate.
Well, what about Salinas?
Andrews grips a phone.
Hold on. Jack! Jack!
Did you check Nilsson's office for any files on Beth Garner?
No police report from Berkeley.
Yeah?
Nothing at all about Salinas.
I'm back. Yeah? Great. Ballistics says the .38 we found in her apartment was used on Nilsson. No registration. They're checking with Salinas. The ice pick was the same brand and model as the Boz weapon.
Check the tape machines at Dr. Garner's apartment and her office, both here and the one on Van Ness. There's no message from Gus on any of them. The tape in her apartment was unused. And Johnny Boz's psychiatrist says he thinks he remembers Dr. Garner and Boz meeting at a Christmas party at his house a year ago.
Walker shakes his head.
You just can't tell about people, can you? Even the ones you think you know inside and out.
He eyes Nick. Talcott enters and breaks into a half smile.
Congratulations, Curran.
Nick stares at him, his brow creased in bewilderment. After a moment, he bows his head. Later, Nick drives to his apartment building and parks. With slumped shoulders, he wearily steps out of his car and trudges toward the entrance. Skyscrapers loom in the distance, stretching up to the indigo sky. Inside, he climbs the stairs to his apartment. He unlocks the front door and enters. Light filters through partially open Venetian blinds, throwing stripes onto the walls. Brushing past Catherine's palm tree, he dumps his keys on a table.
Hi.
He turns to find Catherine standing beside a window. She takes a step closer.
I heard about what happened. TV. I can't allow myself to care about you. I can't allow myself to care. I don't want to do this. Please, I don't want to do this. I lose everybody. I don't want to lose you.
He draws her into an embrace. She wraps her arm around his back.
miss him.
She sobs in his arms, her body trembling. He pulls her closer and squeezes tightly. Later, they lie naked in bed. Nick tenderly kisses Catherine's jaw, working his way up to her chin. His lips find her mouth in a gentle caress. Resting his head on the pillow, he stares into her eyes. Tears cling to her lashes as she warmly studies his face. She strokes his cheek, then rolls on top of him. He brushes her hair with his fingers as she slowly sits up. Straddling him, she begins to rock. He stretches his arms behind him to grab the headboard, then arches his neck. Catherine begins to thrust her hips more frenetically. As she arches her back, her breasts jut toward the ceiling. Her hands slip under the covers. Suddenly, she flings herself forward onto his chest. Catherine lies on top of Nick, her head buried in the pillow. Unharmed, he wraps his arms around her. Catherine sweeps her hair out of her face and kisses his mouth and forehead. Later still, they lie under the covers. With his hand on Catherine's waist, Nick smokes a cigarette. She turns away from him, and his hand slides off her body onto the mattress.
What do we do now, Nick?
Fuck like minks. Raise rugrats and live happily ever after.
Catherine surreptitiously slides her hand toward the floor. As she reaches for something, her brow furrows.
Hey, rugrats.
Nick chuckles.
Fuck like minks. Forget the rugrats and live happily ever after.
Nick turns his back to her and stubs out his cigarette. She looks over her shoulder at him, her arms still dangling over the side of the bed. He eyes her with a curious frown, then lies back down beside her. She slowly raises her arm, reaching toward him. Catherine grabs his neck with her empty hand and pulls him into a passionate kiss. He lies on top of her, hungrily sucking on her neck. The scene fades to black for a moment, then comes back up. Nick and Catherine continue to kiss. He rolls on top of her. We glide away from them down Catherine's side of the bed. A silver-handled ice pick gleams on the floor. Cut to black. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Lisa Benjamin. Descriptions read by Wendy Sacchichini. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. For more information, call DVS toll-free 1-800-333-1203. Or write to our email address, dbs@wgbh.org. Credits roll. Unit Production Manager William S. Beasley. First Assistant Director Louis Desposito. Second Assistant Director Nina Kostroff. Also starring Dorothy Malone. Cast of characters: Michael Douglas as Detective Nick Curran. Sharon Stone as Catherine Trammell. George Zunza as Gus. Jean Triplehorn as Dr. Beth Garner. Dennis Arndt as Lieutenant Walker. Leilani Sorrell as Roxy. Bruce A. Young as Andrews. Chelsea Ross as Captain Talcott. Dorothy Malone as Hazel Dobkins. Wayne Knight as John Corelli. Daniel von Bargen as Lieutenant Nilsson. Stephen Tobolowsky as Dr. Lamotte. Benjamin Mouton as Harrigan. Jack McGee as Sheriff. Bill Cable as Johnny Boz. Stephen Rowe and Mitch Pileggi as the Internal Affairs Investigators. Mary Pat Gleason as Juvenile Officer. Frida Fauchen as Berkeley Registrar. William Duff Griffin as Dr. Myron. James Rebhorn as Dr. McElwain, David Wells as Polygraph Examiner, Bradford English as Campus Policeman, Marianne Rogers and Adila Barnes as the Nurses, Irene Olga Lopez as Maid, Juanita Jennings as Receptionist, Craig C. Lewis as Bartender at the Police Bar, Michael David Lally and Peter Appel as the Detectives, Michael Halton as Bartender at the Country Western Bar, Keith A. McDaniel as Featured Dancer, Eric Popick as Coroner's Guy, Ron Kakis as policeman, Elsie Sniffen as Roxy's friend, Ken Liebenson, Lindy Rasmussen, Byron Berline, Eddie Dunbar, and Todd McKibben as the Duar Riders, Julie Bond as hand puppet model, Michael Runyard as Mr. Douglas's double, Donna Evans and Sandy Baruman as Ms. Stone's doubles, Janet Brady as Ms. Sorrell's stunt double, stunt coordinators M. James Arnett and Charles Piserny, stunt players Seth Arnett, Janine Best, Rocky Capella, Steve Chambers, Mike DeLuna, Justin DeRosa, Gary Epper, John Epstein, Marianne Green, Tom Hoff, Maria Kelly, Janet Orcutt, Randy Peters, and Manny Perry. Los Angeles crew, camera operator Michael Scott, first assistant camera Cal Roberts, Steadicam operator Larry McConkie, first assistant camera Steve Adcock, second assistant camera Steve Matzinger, script supervisor Trudy Ramirez, production sound supervisor Nelson Stoll, CAS, production accountant Jim Davidson, production coordinator Christine A. Johnston, associate to Mr. Verhoeven, Lynn Ehrensberger, assistant production coordinator Bart Brown, optical consultant Bill Cruz of Cruz & Company, set decorator Ann Colgin, special effects coordinator John Fraser, makeup artist David Craig Forrest, hairstylist Paul LeBlanc, post-production supervisor Michael R. Sloan, post-production coordinator Nuri Danahi, first assistant editor Derek G. Brecken, second assistant editor Teresa Longo, apprentice editor Marianne Uriosity, editorial production assistant Douglas Coonan, supervising dialogue editor Scott A. Hecker, dialogue editors David A. Arnold and Susan Dudek, assistant dialogue editor Douglas Kent, ADR supervisor Norman B. Schwartz, ADR editors Rosemary Wheeler and Nick Korda, ADR assistant Barbara Gandolfo Frady, ADR mixers Charlene Richards and Tom O'Connell, ADR voice casting Charing Cross Sound, supervising sound effects editor Stephen H. Flick, MPSE, sound effects editors Ron Bartlett, John Dunn, Donald Flick, Jeffrey G. Rube, and Marvin Wolowitz, Foley editors Dean Beville and Judy Flick, MPSE, assistant sound effects editors Donald Ortiz and Sonny Pettijohn, Foley mixer Greg Orloff, Foley recordist Nurses Gazalian, Foley by Dan O'Connell and Alicia Svensson, sound effects recordists Ken S. Johnson and Eric Potter, special sound effects John Pospisil, re-recording mixers Michael J. Cohut, CAS, Carlos Delarios, and Aaron Roken, CAS, recordists Daniel Sharp and John W. Brilhante, dubbing engineer Eddie Hernandez, projectionist Mike Kaufman, re-recorded at Sony Pictures Studio, music editor Ken Hall, music recorded and mixed by Bruce Botnick, music recorded at the Hit Factory London, music supervisor Harry Shannon, music coordinator Robin Glenn, video playback operator Brad Ralston, sound recordist Fred Runner, cableman Maury Jacks, property master Dennis J. Parrish, gaffer Les Kovacs, key grip Michael Koo, club choreographers Bill and Jackie Landrum, assistant art director Roy Barnes, set designer Steve Berger, illustrator David Lowry, art department assistant Tom Power, assistant set decorator Melinda Ritz, lead man Wayne Shepherd, swing gang Jonathan Bobbitt, Diana Guidara, and Louis Terry, special effects gang boss James D. Schwalm, special effects assistant Hal Selig, standby painter William L. Giroux, costume supervisor Michael Dennison, women's costume supervisor Deborah Hopper, men's costumer Anthony Scarano, still photographer Ralph Nelson, additional hairstylist Virginia G. Hadfield, body makeup Laura Day Atlee, assistant property master Gary Kildrup, assistant props Hope M. Parrish, rigging gaffer E. Christopher Reed, best boy electric Benny McNulty, electricians Paul E. Avery, Scott Gall, Kenneth L. Schneider, and Michael J. Schwartz, best boy grip Bob Babin, dolly grip Joe Graham, rigging grip Paul Threlkeld, grips Donald P. Estes, Christopher Hager, William Leslie, and Randy Troyanik, assistant to Mr. Douglas, Peter DePalma, assistant to Mr. Marshall, Jean Lorette Townsend, assistant to Ms. Stone, Keith Forster, assistant to Mr. Goldsmith, Lois Carruth, production secretary Craig Dietrich, music researcher Bart Brown, club music consultants Tom and Suzanne Hayden, casting assistant Jacqueline Fink, assistant accountants Joel Rosenberg, Kelly Richards-Stitt, and Jeff Ledbetter, second assistant director Michael Viglietta, set production assistants Nancy E. Cox and Cindy Ichikawa, Production assistants Scott Tobin, Greg Smith, Randy Rhodes, and Kate Levine. Painter Craig Shorten. Prop maker Richard Wheeler. Craft service David Schwartz. Extras casting CNEX Casting. Publicist Lauren Beth Strogoff. Public relations Alan Burry of Dennis Davidson Associates. Paramedic coordinator Chris Edmond. Product placement services Rogers and Cowan Incorporated. Transportation coordinator Bryce Williams. Transportation captain Candace Wells. Transportation co-captain Daniel Briggs. Transportation assistant Rich Scheil. Drivers Homer Albin, John Anderson, Chuck Kahn, Mike Davis, Tim Dickinson, Tom Dragna, Mike Greneau, Joe Killian, James Marrett, Carter Nichols, Al Nichol, Troy Tomerlin, Vince Ibiernas, and George Williams. Construction coordinator Stacy McIntosh. General construction foreman Karen Higgins. Construction foremen Chris Chichotka, Daniel Kelly, Sean McCall, Augustin Mendez Jr., and Mark Shea. Paint foreman Richard Giroux. Construction estimator Rob Stevens. Construction gang bosses Richard Anderson, Sharon Barnaby, Mark Bates, James Bergman, Raymond Cooper, Rosemary DiCicco, Augustin Hernandez Jr., Steve Kissick, Randall Prochaska, Bert Rodriguez, Brian Swanson, and Irvin Miller. Special visual effects by Rob Botten. Rob Botten visual effects crew, Fernando Favila, Henry Alvarez, James Clark, Gunnar Ferdinandsen, Art Pimentel, Margaret Prentice, Vincent Prentice, Tom Pressor, Sam Sens, Russ Schinkel, Don Sherlock, Lauren Soman, Wayne Strong, and Todd Weslow. San Francisco crew, art director Mark Billerman, construction coordinator Rich Klott, casting Judith Booley, location manager Ellen Winchell. Additional location managers Amanda Lawford, Gail Stempler, and Susan Griffin. Location scout Paul Gerhardt. Location assistants Montgomery Hom and Scottney Beatty. Key set production assistant Catherine M. McDonald. Assistant accountant Karen Mercurio. Art department assistant Stephen Hessel. Set designer Barbara Mesney. Assistant construction coordinator Raymond E. Mondeau. Set dressing assistant Mary Ellen Leonard. Swing gang George L. Oldham, Bradley T. Martinez, and Matthew Whitting. Lead men, Gary Roloff. Men's costumer, Michael Becker. Assistant props, Michelle L. Souza. Electricians, Joseph G. Emanuel, Frank Helbig, Bill Pelkey, and Kevin Thompson. Wardrobe seamstress, Nancy Foreman. Grips, Donnell Henderson, Mark Lewis, and I.J. Van Peer. General foreman, Keith Urban. Scenic artist, B.J. Fredrickson. Standby painter, Jennifer Clinard. Set production assistants Richard Brodsky and Robin Allen. Production assistants Bernard Dethiers, Heidi Foley, and Nettie Hefner. Drivers Art Casey, Martin Dindia, Jay Haymaker, John Lovelace, and Steve McLaughlin. Caterer Angel Trujillo, Jamie Trujillo, and Ruben Padilla of Angel's Food Service. Craft service Frank Cunha. Paramedic coordinator Christopher Desmond. Location security CNF Security. Second unit San Francisco. Second Unit Director M. James Arnett. First Assistant Director Eric Jewett. Second Assistant Director Annie Spiegelman. Unit Supervisor Clifford Roseman. Director of Photography Michael Ferris. Camera Operator Kim Marks. First Assistant Camera Julian Waitley and Jorgen Wetzeltoft. Second Assistant Camera Jeffrey Greeley and John Malvino. Production Coordinator Joan Wellman. Assistant Production Coordinator Tim August. Location Manager Laurie Knoll. Script supervisor, Peggy Boccini. Location scout, James F. Baldwin. Assistant props, Paul Olson. Location assistant, Michael Hamm. Best boy, Joe Carl Parsons. Makeup and hair, Catherine Childers. Transportation coordinator, Randy Burke. Gaffer, Frank Strolkowski. Production assistants, Nicole Boxer, John Fordham, and Catherine Isaacson. Key grip, Dave Childers. Drivers, Harry Bode, Matt Meza, Mark Muller, and Prentice Woods. Caterer, Sing Ho of Take 5 Catering. Carmel crew, location scout, Peter K. Wolf. Assistant props, Aaron J. Zajac. Grips, Kelly Flood, Francis O. Hughes, Peter Newfield, David Noble, and Mark Ottwald. Electricians, Miles Anderson, Sam Whedon, and Robert Williamson. First aid, Lucille M. Michael. Craft service, Robert Stewart. Aerial unit, helicopter pilots, Robert Bobby Z. Zajac and Alan Perwin. Westcam technicians, Hans Bierno and Steve Koster. Westcam operator, Stan McLean. Fuel truck driver, David Harmon. Title design, Wayne Fitzgerald. Negative cutting, Donna Bassett and Associates. Color by Technicolor Incorporated, Eastman Print Film. Color timer, Bob Putenkowski. Dailies advisor, John Bickford. Opticals by Peter Curran of VCE Incorporated and Cinema Research Corporation. Dolby Stereo consultant, Doug Greenfield. This motion picture was made with the help of Robin Eichmann, Lieutenant Dennis Shard, and the San Francisco Police Department, Ranger Warren White in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, and the Monterey County Film Commission. The producers gratefully acknowledge Lotus Cars, furnished by Lotus Cars USA Incorporated, jewelry by Barry Kieselstein, Cord, Dell Publishing, Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group Incorporated, People Weekly Magazine logo and trademark used with the permission of the Time Incorporated Magazine Company, paintings by Pablo Picasso, copyright 1992 by ARS New York Spatum, Cerruti 1881, Paris, Financial Services, Chemical Bank and Bankers Trust Company, completion bond services provided by Complete Film Corporation, production insurance provided by Albert G. Rubin and Company, songs, Movin' On Up, written by Jeff Barry and Janet Dubois, courtesy of ELP Communications. Rave the Rhythm, performed by Channel X, written by Van Lierop, Kahn, and Adams, courtesy of Beatbox Antler Subway Records. Glowing in the Ashes, performed by the Doo-Wah Riders, written by Ken Liebenson. Looking for the Summer, written and performed by Chris Ray, courtesy of Atco Records Warner Music UK Limited, by arrangement with Warner Special Products. Blue, written and performed by Latour, courtesy of Smash Records. Original soundtrack available on Varese Sarabande compact discs and cassettes. Clip from The Jeffersons, courtesy of Columbia Pictures Television. Copyright 1992 by ELP Communications, all rights reserved. Clip from Hellraiser, courtesy of Transatlantic Entertainment. Read the New American Library book. Filmed with Panavision cameras and lenses. Filmed on location in San Francisco, Carmel, and at Warner Hollywood Studios. Copyright 1992 by Carol Kohler Studio Canal Plus VOF. All rights reserved. Unauthorized duplication is prohibited. A logo, Carolco, denotes a trademark of Carolco Pictures Incorporated, registered in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. A logo, Le Studio Canal Plus, denotes a trademark of Le Studio Canal Plus, registered in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Carolco Le Studio Canal Plus VOF is the author of this film for the purpose of copyright and other laws. The Motion Picture Association of America emblem, number 31380. Spectral recording by Dolby Stereo in selected theaters. This picture made under the jurisdiction of IATSE affiliated with AFL-CIO. The story, all names, characters, and incidents portrayed in this production are fictitious. No identification with or similarity to any actual persons, living or dead, or to actual events or entities is intended or should be inferred. This motion picture is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries. Any unauthorized exhibition, distribution, or reproduction of this motion picture or videotape, or any part thereof, including the soundtrack, may result in severe civil and criminal penalties. A logo. A winged horse leaps over a triangle. A TriStar release. This motion picture has been rated R, restricted. Under 17 requires accompanying parent or adult guardian by the Classification and Rating Administration of the Motion Picture Association of America. A point of blue neon light arcs back and forth, forming a letter C with five layers. White light spins from the C as the color fades to black and white. Carolco Home Video. Exclusively distributed by Live Home Video, a live entertainment company.